The self-proclaimed republics of Donetsk and Lugansk, as well as two other regions in Ukraine, hold the fifth and final day of referendums on joining Russia. Turkey protests over Greece deploying dozens of U.S. armored vehicles on non-military islands in the Aegean Sea. Also in this newscast, Japan's decision to hold a state funeral for assassinated former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe becomes controversial. Hello and welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi and these are our top stories this hour. People in four Ukrainian regions are voting on the fifth and final day of referendums on joining Russia. The polls are underway in the self-proclaimed republics of Lugansk and Donetsk in the east, as well as the Russian-controlled parts of Kherson. Russia has already said that it will give full protection to the regions if they vote to join the country. President Vladimir Putin has also backed the referendums. However, Ukraine says those who are involved in the process will face treason charges. The U.S. and its Western allies have also strongly criticized the referendum as a sham and illegitimate. They have promised to continue their military support for Kiev. For more on that, we're joined by our correspondent, Johnny Miller, who is once again in the region of Donetsk, keeping a close watch on the developments there. And also we have with us Tim Kirby, radio host and political analyst from Moscow. Let's begin with Johnny. Give us an update. Of course, you told us about what you would expect the outcomes to be, but if you could please elaborate more on that.
Yeah, I've been to a couple of the polling stations here in Donetsk, in the Donbass region this morning. There's a palpable mood of excitement and joy amongst the pro-Russian citizens who are voting today. And indeed, Donbass is likely, the vast majority of people here in this particular region of Donbass are very pro-Russian and are looking forward to joining Russia. They will vote yes. Why will they? Many people say to me that since the 2014 Ukrainian government has been suppressing their culture, their language, and indeed bombing this region for over 8 years. Just behind me, a week ago, a missile fired by the Ukrainians landed just in the street behind me, and there was a body of a woman. She was killed lying just in the grass, just some meters behind me. So people here very excited to join Russia. There will be a minority of Ukrainians very upset and angry that this referendum is taking place. And indeed, in two other regions, Kherson and Zaporozhye, there it's a lot more mixed. There'll be many, many, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, I expect, pro-Ukrainians who will be very upset about this election. Many of them won't vote out of protest. Many will be feeling intimidated by the authorities there. And so many Ukrainians will be very upset this referendum is happening at all. Of course, it's important to recognize as well that no country in the world apart from Russia has has legitimized these elections. NATO and Ukraine, of course, as you say, have condemned them in the strongest possible terms. But Russia and the local authorities here are moving on regardless.
Okay, so Tim Kirby, you just heard our correspondent Johnny Miller from Donetsk predicting pretty much the likely result to this referendum as a positive response to joining Russia. So, in your opinion, how would that change the geopolitics of the region, particularly considering the operations that Russia has carried out in Ukraine?
Well, the thing is that what Russia's been doing on the territory of 1991 Ukraine, we can call it, is very similar to what it was doing and still is doing to an extent in Syria. So the Assad government asked the Russians to come in and help. The Russians told them that, Assad, you're going to have to fight this, but we'll support you. And that's how that worked out. And this is very similar in that Russia pledged to support the break of the republics as independent nations. Now that they're going to become a part of Russia proper, this really changes the rules. This is no longer some sort of means of assistance, but any attacks that would be on Russia would be considered to be essentially an act of war against Russia itself. In fact, they've already declared, as many political analysts assume today, that this is going to turn into an anti-terrorist action, I believe was the proper terminology, to remove the rest of the Ukrainian forces from these four regions. However, if they continue to fight, then real traditional total war, in the sort of World War II sense of total war, would be declared, and that would change the nature of the conflict very much.
Exactly. So, Johnny, do you believe that the West and its allies, Europe actually, and the U.S., Western Europe and the U.S., would actually go to that length?
Well, yes, and also I might state that this process looks like it'll happen very quickly. I've sources in the Russian government, indeed local authorities, say that once this referendum is announced, when the results are announced, it could happen as quickly as a week that Russia takes over these territories. So as your other guest was saying, it will most likely escalate this conflict. But I think in terms of Ukrainian and NATO response, I think this will be a crucial moment, a test, if you will, of Ukraine and NATO's will about how much they want to continue to fight fighting this war. It'll also be crucial this coming winter. Of course, gas prices are rising massively in particularly European countries, threatening European industries, and that'll be a major test of will, particularly for the European powers, of whether they want to continue supporting Ukraine. And many analysts say that it's a war that Ukraine ultimately can't win. Russia has huge mobilizing potential. They can mobilize over 25 million men. And for Russia, this is very much an existential war. Russia feels that it cannot lose this war. And so it's difficult to see Ukraine, even with NATO weapons, being able to defeat Russia. But it looks like all the sounds are that NATO and Ukraine are determined to continue as long as it takes.
So, Tim, could you please tell us some more about how Russia is actually playing this game? It seems that Russia is creating some kind of a corridor there. On the other hand, let's not forget that Russia always wanted to have some kind of a buffer zone between its borders and a NATO-allied country. How will that change if these regions are annexed to Russia?
Well, if we talk about then, you mentioned sort of the goals or what Russia's plans are. The ultimate goals have been from the beginning, denazification and demilitarization of Ukraine. How that's going to look like, we haven't seen a stable definition, so maybe those end goals are a bit flexible. However, from a geopolitical standpoint and from a historical standpoint, taking the region around Odessa is very logical. Why? Because it'll landlock Ukraine is the first part. Number two, Odessa has been a very pro-Russian region of Ukraine and very much identifies with Russia, despite the fact that it's also known as probably the most Jewish location of the USSR. Odessa region also borders on Moldova and especially Transnistria, which is a part of Moldova that kind of has wanted to break away since the early 1990s, but has remained very much in the same way that the breakaway republics of Donetsk and Lugansk wanted to break away from the rest of Ukraine after the Maidan. So that's another potential powder keg, that having the Russian military border that region would essentially diffuse that conflict, because the Moldovan leadership knows that if they went to war with Russia, things would be even worse than it was for Kiev. So that's very important on that front. On a more moralistic front, the Russian population is very disappointed with what happened around Kharkov, with the Russians sort of moving their troops back to the Ukrainian counteroffensive, because wherever the Ukrainians go, very few civilians seem to survive. And so there's definitely was a public outcry to do something about that, and there's definitely a political will to bring Kharkov into the fold. What will go beyond that, I don't know, but it seems absolutely logical for Russia to push all the way to the Dnieper River, take everything east of it, and then everything that extends towards Moldova. That's the most logical, historically plausible, geopolitically stable pathway that they could take. Will they do that? We don't know.
Thank you very much, Tim Kirby, radio host and political analyst from Moscow. Also, our correspondent, Johnny Miller, joining us live from Donetsk, keeping a close watch on the results of that referendum, which is currently underway for the final day in four regions in Ukraine. Moving on, Russia's president has granted citizenship to American whistleblower Edward Snowden amid heightened tensions with the U.S. over the war in Ukraine. The Kremlin says President Putin approved citizenship for the former U.S. intelligence contractor after he filed a relevant request. Snowden has been living in Russia for the past 9 years. He was given asylum in 2013 after Washington revoked his American passport for exposing secret files related to the U.S. National Security Agency. The documents revealed vast domestic and international surveillance operations by the NSA. He is now facing charges of espionage and theft of government property in the U.S., which could put him in prison for decades. State Department spokesman Ned Price said on Monday that Snowden should return to the U.S. to face justice. The UK's pound sterling has slumped to a record low against the dollar in the wake of the government's last week announcement of the biggest tax cuts in 50 years. Our correspondent Said Puraza reports.
The British pound takes a pounding yet again, only days after the country's finance minister announced the biggest tax-cutting package in decades, all funded by borrowing at a time of high inflation. They termed it a mini-budget, but it was a mega-shift in direction. The Chancellor confirmed the government would implement Prime Minister Liz Truss's leadership campaign pledges to reverse the national insurance rise, cancel the corporation tax rise, and a surprise new tax cut for the highest earners.
Take the additional rate of income tax. At 45%, it is currently higher than the headline top rate in G7 countries like the US and Italy. And it is even higher than social democracies like Norway. But I'm not going to cut the additional rate of tax today, Mr. Speaker. I'm going to abolish it altogether.
Ordinary Britons may not think about exchange rates on a daily basis, but a fall in the pound will affect their day-to-day.
Britain imports nearly half of its foodstuffs, and therefore the pound gets weaker, the cost of that those basic foodstuffs goes up dramatically. And so anything which is coming in will be hitting inflation at a time when you don't want to have that. The only good news part of actually of this would be actually your exports are now better value. The trouble is if the global demand is shrinking, therefore the demand for those exports would also be shrinking.
There are also concerns about a long recession as winter looms with no end in sight to the energy crisis or the war in Ukraine. Online calls for a general election are gaining traction. And in the Conservative Party itself, rumors about a no-confidence vote in the brand new prime minister.
Some experts say the UK's central bank, the Bank of England, could intervene to halt the pound sliding. Many others are saying the government's decision to borrow its way out of the current situation could end in tears. Said Puraza, London.
Ankara has summoned the Greek ambassador over alleged provocations in the Aegean Sea, where the two sides have been at odds over the status of the two islands. Turkey is angered by Greece for deploying armored vehicles on the two islands of Lesbos and Samos. Ankara says that this is in violation of the international law and is calling on Athens to respect the formally agreed non-military status of the area. The Turkish government has also sent a protest note to the U.S. that after Ankara shared recorded aerial images showing ships loaded with U.S.-made military equipment docking at the islands. In response, Greece has rejected Turkish accusations as unfounded. The two nations are at odds over a slew of issues, including commercial rights in the Asian and territorial waters in the eastern Mediterranean Sea. Japan is holding a state funeral for assassinated former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, but the government is receiving a backlash with many people opposing the ceremony. Hundreds have gathered near the venue of the event in the capital, Tokyo, in protest. Over the past weeks, Japan has witnessed growing public opposition to the ceremony. Thousands of people have signed a petition against the move over its cost, but that is not the only source of their anger. There have been a number of revelations about links between the former prime minister's political party and a controversial religious group known as the Unification Church. Abe was shot dead on the 8th of July when he was attending a campaign rally in the city of Nara. He was the longest-serving prime minister in Japan. Tensions are spiraling in the Korean Peninsula as the South and the U.S. begin joint war games. North Korea is now warning of war.
The United States is now planning, even at this moment, to conduct joint military exercises, which arouses serious concerns in the surroundings of the Korean Peninsula. Obviously, this is an extremely dangerous act of igniting the fuse to drive the situation on the Korean Peninsula to the brink of war.
Addressing the UN General Assembly, Kim also criticized the UN Security Council for imposing sanctions on the North Koreans over its nuclear program. He said the UNSC punishes Pyongyang for bolstering its defense capabilities but remains silent on the reckless U.S. arms buildup and war crimes. The U.S. has stationed nearly 30,000 troops in South Korea. Its joint naval drills on South Korea's east coast are the first in 5 years and come a day after Pyongyang conducted another ballistic missile launch. North Korea sees such drills as a preparation for an invasion. Earlier this month, the North revised its nuclear weapons law, allowing it to carry out a first strike and vowing never to give up its nukes. And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
We here at Arabi English Radio express our heartfelt condolences to all of our Muslim listeners on the occasion of 30th of Safar, the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Reza, peace be upon him, the 8th infallible successor to Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny.
Insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing the current crisis in the global economic and financial system with Russian economist Sergei Glazyev. But first, this brief analysis.
Even before the war in Ukraine and the severe Western sanctions imposed on Russia, the global economic and financial system was entering a period of transition. Changes in the relative economic power of nations, particularly those of rising powers in Asia, began to challenge America's global financial and economic hegemony. In the US itself, more than 20 years of permanent global war in the name of fighting terrorism has financially, politically, and morally corrupted America. The financialization of the U.S. economy destroyed U.S. production and has created one of the greatest wealth gaps in history, with tens of millions of Americans living in poverty and hunger, and a handful of oligarchs with unfathomable wealth wasting it on personal pet projects. More than ever before in recent history, the United States is weaponizing economic sanctions, the global banking system, and the US dollar itself to wage economic war against whatever country that is not complying with its orders. This, in turn, is destroying the credibility of the very global financial system that the United States imposed on the world following World War II. The severe sanctions imposed on Russia by the West have exacerbated this larger historic transition because, for the first time, the majority of non-Western nations did not comply with Western orders to sanction Russia. And Europe is also suddenly faced with a severe crisis because of its dependency on Russian energy and raw materials. For the first time, there are serious efforts to replace the US dollar as the international trade currency, as well as efforts to create new international financial systems independent of the West. New systems which cannot be abused and weaponized by the West to wage economic war on peoples around the world. It's not yet clear how these new global economic and financial systems will look like, but what is clear is that they will be centered in Asia and will be very different than what existed previously.
Dr. Glazev, thank you so much for joining us on Insight. Doctor, you know, it's interesting because you wrote, prior to the Ukraine conflict, you wrote in your books, in your articles, about particular trends that were already occurring in the global economic and financial situation of the world. Things like weaponization of the dollar, things like using and abusing the banking system, that is the Western banking system that is dominated by the West, for political ends, for punishing countries. A lot of these other issues, which are very many, which we can't all list now in our conversation. And you were at that time already predicting that the current financial system in the world, the current economic banking system in the world, is going to change, and that we're going to be going through a transition. And of course, all of this was accelerated by the Ukrainian conflict and the reaction that the West showed to Russia, the sanctioning, the basically stealing of Russian foreign reserves in foreign banks, something that, of course, we as Iranians are very used to. This is nothing new for us, and we welcome you to the club now. So if you could please explain for our audience in as much detail as possible, what is the current global financial situation dominated by the West that is now coming to an end? Some of the main features of it, some of those main issues as to this current situation, and how is it that we are now transitioning away from this current system and into a new system?
Well, thank you very much for this opportunity. I shall try to explain the current situation from the viewpoint of the theory of long-term economic development. I am an expert in this long-term cycles theory, and the present situation is a situation of transition. The world is changing dramatically. It's changing both technologically and institutionally. This time, we are going through two transitions. The first transition is technological revolution, the transition to the new technological mode, which means that the economy is suffering from the drastic changes in the technological structure. Each technological structure is the basis for the so-called Kondratiev long wave.
Yes.
These cycles have 50 years length, and every 50 years we have approximately we have technological revolution. This period is a period of depression in the economy, because the companies, especially in the developed countries, are suffering from the excess of capital in the obsolete industries. Mm-hmm. And it takes time to transfer capital from the obsolete industries to the new one. This transition started about 15 years ago And now it is coming to the end. The new technological mode, which is based on nanotechnologies, information technologies, digital technologies, biotechnologies, bioengineering technologies, and now is formed, and its expansion is going on the with the accelerated growth. The growth rate of this new technologies is about 35% per year. At the same time, we are going through the institutional change. Changes are taking place in with much more longer periods. The Italian scholar and banker Arrighi studied the so-called long-term cycles, or he called this century cycles, systemic cycles of capital accumulations. And each such cycle is based on the specific institutional structure. For instance, during the last two centuries, we have seen the changes from the colonial type of economy, which was based on the huge world powers in Europe, British Empire, colonial empire, French Empire, Russian Empire, and so forth. Those colonial period of capital accumulation is more or less good explanations given by Marx. Mm-hmm. He showed in his papers that the main feature of this kind of economic structure is antagonistic conflict between labor and capital. This colonial period was characterized by the slave trade, by the exploitation of all over the world by the European empires, and there were no any social rights, no trade unions, nothing which could protect workers from the exploitations from the capitalists. This colonial type structure collapsed in the beginning of the 20th century. The First World War and the Second World War were provoked by the British in order to maintain the British Empire as a leader of the world. The point is that this transition period from one cycle to the another cycle usually is going on through the world wars, because the ruling elite of the leading countries do not want any changes. And at that time, 100 years ago, we have seen two world wars. Both were provoked and organized by British, and the Second World War also by the Americans, who made a huge investments in militarization on German Empire. And the idea of these two wars designed by the British was to have a conflict between Russia and Germany in order to prevent their development. At the beginning of the 20th century, Germany and Russian Empire together were in very close relations. And they produced more goods and they were more advanced. They had faster growth rates than British Empire. And it was quite clear that Russian and German Empire, together with Austrian Empire and Ottoman Empire, becomes a new center of the world. In order to prevent this formation of the new center of the world, British provoked the First World War, which destroyed all those empires, and Europe was also destroyed, and British maintained their world leadership till the Second World War. But at the same time, we have seen the Russian Socialist Revolution and the emergency of the principally new institutional structure. It was a structure based on the central planning economy, which was very new, and which demonstrated a huge growth rates. The industrialization growth rates of not only of industrial production, but of the whole economy in the Soviet Russia was the highest in the world at that time. At the same time, In the United States, another type of this new institutional structure also emerged based on the transnational corporations. From the organizational point of view, the Soviet system and the American system were rather similar. The basic unit in organizational structure was large corporation. In the Soviet Union, it was called ministries, which organized production in this or that industries. In the Western world, they were transnational corporations. For the first time in the history, the governments invented the fiat money, which they used in endless scale. Mm-hmm. The government, the central banks, government central banks, started to print money in those quantities which were necessary to finance investments for economic development. For the first time, we have seen that the monetary limits were overcome. There were no any problems for the finance industrialization in the Soviet Union because the state bank printed as much money as were necessary to finance the growth of productions and investments. The only limits were physical resources. At the same time, in the United States, the Federal Reserve emerged, and Federal Reserves also started to print money in those quantities which were necessary for the American government to finance its budget and to stimulate economic growth. These two principally new, but politically opposite systems, they were common in the way of organization of production, but they were opposite in the political sense. In America, we have seen democracy, in Russia, communist totalitarian state. In spite of the political antagonism, those two systems demonstrated very fast growth, especially the Soviet systems, which didn't suffer from the Great Depression. The Great Britain started to lose its hegemony again. And again, they started to provoke the New World War, again, between Russia, between Soviet Union and Germany. Finally, the war finished with the political results, which was very astonishing for the British, because the British lost the empire, in spite of the fact that they were among the winners. They lost empire because the two superpowers emerged, the Soviet Union and United States, which were much more efficient than the British colonial type state.
That's right.
These large-scale corporations and ministries organized production, mass production, in much more efficient way than have been done by the private companies in the British Empire. So British Empire collapsed, the so-called imperial, as we define it, imperial world order began, dominated by the two superpowers. Now this cycle comes to the end. Mm-hmm. First, we have seen the collapse of the Soviet Union about 30 years ago.
Yes.
Now we are looking for the collapse of the United States. The Soviet Union collapsed because the central planning economy was very rigid, and it didn't satisfy for the needs of the science and technological progress. This was very a bureaucratic system which reject innovations, and finally the Soviet Union began to go in, down in technological competition. And after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the United States becomes the only one leader. But this leadership was not forever, because the American system today is based on the creation of the fiat capital, which has no limits. You see, according to the Arrighi studies, mm-hmm. Each one-century cycle of the accumulation of capital has two phases. The first phase is material expansion. The new system of management, the new, more efficient institutions give opportunity for those countries which use these institutions to become the leaders in the industrial production, in the rail sector. But after two generations, the leadership in industrial sector transfers to the leadership in the financial sector. Mm-hmm. And the second half of this century is the financial expansions. Financial expansion of American capital now have such a scale that the efficiency in the rail sector simply doesn't matter. During the last 10 years, maybe 12 years, the amount of dollars in the world economy increased about four times. At the same time, we see that in China and in India emerge the new technology, a new economic system, which have much more complicated structure, which combine the central strategic planning with the market competition mechanism. The government control the money circulation through the government, through the state banking system. And at the same time, the private entrepreneurs, the private companies has access to the endless credit facilities, but they get this access only in those spheres which increase the production of the goods which have consumer demand. So this combination of central strategic planning and private markets and companies' competition gives new opportunities for the economic growth. The government creates, the central bank, government central bank creates money. The government controls the circulation of this money. It's do in such a way to avoid the speculations. They give opportunity to the private companies have a long-term credits, maybe half, 0.5 interest rate, even 0.2 interest rates, which are provided by the government banks for those companies which are able to produce more goods and give more opportunities for economic growth. And the government at the same time block the speculations which undermine the economic stability. For this reason, almost all money which are created by the state are going to the rail sector. Mm-hmm. And today we see that monetization of the Chinese economy about two times higher than American economies. Almost the amount of money which were created by the Chinese state bank during the last 12 years increased about three times. But this money was not going to the financial speculations as in the United States. It was going to the production sector. And we see that Chinese corporations like Huawei, let's say, or Xiaomi, or China Construction, or Power Engineering Company, becomes the huge old corporations. They were created, especially in the private sector, like Huawei or Xiaomi, they were created just from nothing, from private cooperatives, which are growing up very fast because the government support these companies with the cheap credits. But at the same time, the government control with the use of the money. It's avoid the capital flight. The currency control is very strong. The yuan, RMB, is convertible only for current transactions, for trade, but it is not convertible for the capital transactions. The capital flows are controlled by the government. And all this monetary mechanism is designed in such a way to promote investments. You see, the Chinese, as well as Indian and maybe Iranian financial system, has a clear goal to finance, first of all, new investments, to finance the growth of production, which is quite different from the American and Western system. where the money are created for the needs of the financial oligarchs. They print money in huge quantities without taking care where this money are going. The main idea to get cheaper profits. For this reason, they create various derivatives, which in fact are pure speculative instruments. And these financial bubbles concentrate about 80% of the whole money created by the Federal Reserve. And the mechanism which we see at the moment in the West, financial mechanism, is going through the turbulence. It becomes very turbulent. Every 10 years, we have the financial crisis. And there is completely, almost no economic growth. There is no growth of the real income of the population. So American and European economy is in stagnation. At the same time, the Chinese and Indian economies are growing up very fast. So the world economy is switched to the new center in the South East Asia. We see the new world economic center, which dominates now in the world economy by the growth rates. More than 50% of the growth of the world economy is the growth in those Asian countries. This center is much more efficient. It wins economic competition. And the Pax Americana is going to the end, not because Chinese and Indian economies are growing up so fast, not because they were in miserable situation before. They're growing up very fast because they have much more efficient system of management, much more efficient institutional system. So this new type of economic organization combines the central planning for central strategic planning and private entrepreneurs. We call this type of state as integrative state or integrated world economic mode. Because the main function of the state is the combination of the interests, the harmonization of the interests of various social groups. The American style system is designed for the needs of the financial oligarchy.
Exactly.
The American system protects property rights for the large capital, and they don't care about the workers, about the population as a whole. And for this reason, we see the huge social differentiation, which finally go into the political destabilization, which we have seen during the last presidential elections in the United States.
Exactly.
As for the new type of the state in Asia, we see the socialist ideology, we see the huge role of the moral standards. The state is responsible before the people. The main idea of the economic policy is the growth of the incomes and living standards of the population. So this combination of the socialist ideology, of the traditional values, of market mechanism and central strategic planning, government control over the money creation, shows the huge efficiency. And it is no doubt that the last part of the present century will be dominated by the competition between China and India. Unfortunately, cost about 100 million people killed in the two world wars organized by the British Empire. And now the American financial and ruling elite is trying to maintain its leadership, starting the new world war. We call this war hybrid war, because the main front lines in this war are going in the financial sector, in the economic and trade sector, in information technologies, and only the final stage, they use the military power in order to press opposition and in order to finalize the expansion in the financial and economic and information sectors. But this is the real world war, because the idea of this world war, hybrid world war, is from the American side, is to maintain its world hegemony, and they don't care about other countries. Those countries which are not controlled by the United States are going through the culture, through the color revolutions. Exactly. The Americans are trying to undermine political stability. In those countries which they do not have control, they introduce various methods for chaotization of those countries. They provoke wars between countries. The main idea of them was to provoke the war between Russia and China. Fortunately, it didn't happen. Now the Russia and China have strategic partnership. And because the China is too large now, and American lose the economic competition with China, they're trying now to press Russia, to undermine Russia, to destroy Russia, in order to improve its position in the world by means of controlling the Russia natural resources and to prevent the growth of China. So American plan today has three stages. The first one, to destroy Russia, because, the Russophobia is one of the long-term, have deep roots in Anglo-Saxon geopolitics.
Exactly.
The whole geopolitics theory of the 19th century, designed by the English and Germans, was some quasi-science how to destroy the Russian Empire. It was the main headache of the Western geopoliticians to find methods how to destroy Russian Empire. And the Ukrainian crisis, the war today in Ukraine, happened according to the recommendations of their geopolitical theory, starting from Bismarck and then following with Brzezinski. They stressed a lot of times that in order to destroy Russia, first of all, you have to get away Ukraine from Russia. Because the formula of Brzezinski was that Russia without Ukraine couldn't be the superpower. And all this Russophobia, which was have deep roots in the Anglo-Saxon geopolitics, now played a key role. Why the United States use Russia as the main goal to maintain the world hegemony. Ukrainian provocation was prepared on the systemic basis during the 20 years, especially the last 8 years. They trying to control Ukraine. As you know, they organized the coup d'etat in Ukraine. The Ukraine during the last 8 years do not have independent government. Territory is totally controlled by the CIA and other American and British organizations. And the first stage for them is of this hybrid war. In fact, hybrid war began with the sanctions against Russia in 2014. And then the second stage was the economic war with China. Where the American used the same methods as the British Empire used in the 30s, when British Empire prevented the access of American goods to their empire in order to get more compatible position in comparison with the United States. Now the United States did the same. They launched the trade war with China in order to maintain their markets and in order to limit the growth of China, but they failed in this war.
فيلم فيخ از علوم شریفه اسلامی است و Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamat yek asle zinde ast dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech on Arab English Radio, Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Husseini Qomi. Stay tuned.
دو نفر آمدن محضر وجود مقدس خاتم الانبیا برای قضاوت دعوایی داشتن.
Two persons fought and to solve their problems came to Prophet Muhammad to judge between them. As you might know, Prophet Muhammad in such cases used to act as a judge and not a prophet. In other words, he didn't use his prophetic powers in judging between two people. Prophet Muhammad used to say, I judge based on proofs, evidences, and witnesses, and not my knowledge of the unseen world. Now, among the two persons who came to Prophet Muhammad, one of them had more evidences and proofs, so basically, he was going to win the case.
قهرن پیامبر خدا قضاوت کردن حق رو به کسی دادن که سند داشت مدرک داشت شاهد
Prophet Muhammad judged and gave the right to the person who had more evidences for his claim. When the other one lost the case, he accused Prophet Muhammad of a wrong judgment and made him upset. Upon hearing his sentences, Prophet Muhammad stated, I judged based on the proofs and evidences. However, if you have any complaint, you can ask for your right. It is not right to neglect your right and then ask Allah to give you the right on the day of judgment. This sentence of Prophet Muhammad means that asking for one's rights, if they are based on evidences, must not be postponed to the day of judgment. And we are allowed to ask for our rights here in this world. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Husseini Qomi. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en/Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.